Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will talk with award-winning documentarian Stephen Most about his book, Stories Make the World: Reflections on Storytelling and the Art of the Documentary. He uses a variety of sources and experiences to explore the quest for truthful reality in nonfiction filmmaking. Welcome, Stephen Most. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for talking to me.
Hi, Joel. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast.
Well, I wanted to say up front that I am someone who tends to view documentaries over typical films and videos. I find your book to be particularly of interest to me because I've got a number of degrees, including a library degree, and then I'm also have a history major, master's. And so, as you can imagine, nonfiction is the kind of thing that I'm more interested in anyway. So documentary film have always been, especially nowadays, where you can get so many documentaries from so many different places. So that's why I found this book to be particularly of interest to me. But let's start with some background. Obviously, you have experience as a documentarian already, both writing and filmmaking. So, and then of course, this led you to write as well, books. But what led you to become a documentary filmmaker? Well, educational and learning experiences that got you to that point?
I started my writing career as a playwright. I'm still a playwright, and that involves a certain way of looking at the world in which there are multiple perspectives, and that things don't come out the way anyone expects. It's actually good training for history. I found that writing, I went into journalism from playwriting because I like to do research. I want to find out things that I don't know, write about subjects that are unfamiliar to me, get to know people who I normally wouldn't meet in my life. My introduction to documentary filmmaking came when I had an opportunity to accompany a film crew to actually Lawrence Livermore Labs. I was writing a play, a comedy about nuclear technology, and as an independent writer, I didn't have access to the subject of my play. So I found, first of all, doing interviews with documentary film crews that I could speak with almost anyone. I went to an anti-nuclear demonstration in Central Park in 1982, and there was a line of famous people wanting to be on television, and I got to talk to them. I went to a conference in New York, and there were people I've admired for years whose books I've read. I got to ask them the best questions I could think of. So making documentaries really opened the world up for me as a writer who had concentrated on plays before. And then I found out that many documentary filmmakers really didn't know about dramatic structure. There was this idea that some had that you could just go out into the world with the camera, and that's reality, and then you give it to an editor, and you've got a movie. Somehow the editor figures it all out. Well, a playwright can, of course, conceive of a story from scratch, figure out where it begins, where it ends, who the main characters are, what the central action is, what the theme is that plays out during the show. And these concepts of dramaturgy that have been around for 25 centuries, it turns out, are very valuable for documentary filmmakers in shaping what we do. So I found myself working after just interviewing with film crews, working from their projects sometimes when they couldn't figure out how to put their story together. And that got me into documentary film.
It's interesting. What happened with your play, your comedy about nuclear technology? Did you ever finish it?
Oh, yes. It's had a couple of productions. And in fact, because of that visit to Livermore, I learned quite a lot about the technology that I was writing about. It's not the kind of information that one can put into a comedy, but I always like to have some idea of what the subject, some idea of the subject that I'm writing about.
At first glance, I would say that that doesn't seem to be a topic that lends itself to comedy, but then we've had comedies about Korea and World War II and World War, you know, and other wars and things. So I guess a comedy about nuclear, sometimes that's all you can do is laugh at it, though, in some ways. Maybe that's the only way you can completely live with it.
Well, that's right. I did a previous play with a theater company, the Del Arte Players Company, that uses Commedia dell'arte performance styles. And the plot was pretty much like the China Syndrome, that movie about a meltdown of the nuclear reactor. Only we did ours a couple of years before that. And of course, the China Syndrome came out the year of Three Mile Island's meltdown. And it really dramatized the power of the arts to put a spotlight on an issue that is a public concern.
I guess it's not completely different in the sense that we had Failsafe and then and Dr. Strangelove at about the same time. And it was the same idea. Story for both of them were very, very similar. One was a comedy, though, and the other one wasn't. And it was an interesting way to look at the topic two different ways.
That's right. So I've learned a tremendous amount doing documentaries. I've been able to explore many different subjects of interest to me, including astronomy. There was a film about the search for intelligent life in elsewhere in the universe. I don't think we found enough of it on Earth. Learning about ecology, about the lives of people I admire greatly. I've been fascinated by the Klamath River and the history of the Klamath River. So in many cases, documentary films have begun a journey for me to learn about things that concern me. My current film is about wildfires and climate change.
Okay.
Just about to finish that. And while making that film, I wrote a chapter for my book, Stories Make the World, Reflections on Storytelling and the Art of the Documentary. So most of the chapters of that book have to do with the way that I approach a subject in the world and turn it into a story that people will watch.
I know that it's my experience with, you know, if you talk to people who don't have, especially prior nowadays, as I say, it's so easy to find documentaries everywhere. I suspect more people are watching documentaries nowadays than ever before. But one of the things I remember, especially when the best examples I can think of is Michael Moore and his documentaries, were that people got upset because they said, well, wait a minute, this isn't a documentary. He's saying something. He's trying to make a point. This shouldn't be, you know, they thought documentaries were supposed to be just like school films where all they do is tell you, you know, how to wash your hands and how to do things, how to get along with other people, that they're not supposed to have a point of view. And luckily now people have gotten away from, even now, if you talk to people about documentaries, they seem a little surprised that when you say, well, a documentary, like any art, usually, as you point out, it's supposed to have a story. It's supposed to have a point. And it is interesting how over time, you talk about that a lot, obviously, in the book, about the story is one of the most important aspects of any documentary.
The story is, and a filmmaker will have a point of view, will be fascinated in a subject, or maybe wants to express a point about, for example, the connection between wildfires and climate change. But at the same time, a documentary film is, if it's good, it's going to reach millions of people. Millions of people with different points of view, different experience, different backgrounds. And if it's going to succeed, it's got to be credible. The facts have got to be right. All of the divergent perspectives have to be taken into account and allowed to present themselves. So although a filmmaker might have all sorts of opinions and ideas that we want to get across, in approaching our subject and in representing it, we have to be impartial. In that respect, a filmmaker is like a scientist or a judge. a scientific experiment will have a hypothesis, but it has to withstand the test. And a scientist especially is looking for evidence that can prove the hypothesis wrong. It has to withstand any theory, any hypothesis has to withstand the test of opposing evidence. And in the case of documentaries, facts that aren't convenient in terms of what you would like to believe and that you like other people to think about. In the case of law, yes, there's a defendant, there's a charge against the defendant, but that has to be proven also, and all of the relevant evidence is brought to bear in determining whether the charge is correct or not. So a documentary filmmaker will start out with ideas, start out with a point of view, but that perspective keeps enlarging as one meets more and more people. When the time one gets to a completed film, there's an enlarged view of the subject that the filmmaker has and can share with the audience.
Yeah, you mentioned that early on in your introduction, excuse me, that there's a difference between, I forgot the way you put it, but objectivity is not something that a documentarian is not necessarily trying to be objective, but they, as you point out, they still want to be truthful. And just like any other industry where, you know, anything that's trying to inform or educate or even just entertain, you have to have it. It's got to have the believability factor. It's one of the reasons why we, you know, these days, especially with all this, and I know it, the word that even got on one of the blurbs on the back of your book about fake news, and that suddenly has become, it's always been an issue. It's nothing new, but lately it has become so much of an issue because nowadays people are just putting anything up and claiming that this is true or vice versa, or people are being, you know, they're being said, well, that's not really true. I don't believe that, even though there's evidence. And as you point out, it's real. You've got proof, you've got documentation and other kinds of things to try to prove what you're saying. So it is a topic that's always been around, but particularly these days, I think the concepts that you're talking about are particularly important.
Some people say that this is a golden age of documentaries. Documentaries have grown tremendously in popularity. You see nonfiction films in multiplexes. That wasn't the case, or very rarely the case, 20, 30 years ago. So there's an appetite for documentaries. And I think that's because of our media environment. People get information out of context. They get tweets. They get scattered bits in their news feeds. What a documentary does is put information into the broadest possible context and gives people an opportunity to explore what it means and also to, in many cases, take seriously divergent points of view. I think there's an appetite for that in the public. There's certainly a need for that as people want to understand the world. People who are not satisfied by somebody's obviously partisan biased rant.
And it's that part of it. But then there's the other part. Not only do you want it to be, you want to make sure you're presenting reality or truth. And even in nonfiction films, that's what I think is going back to what I said before, is that one of the problems we run into are these so-called docudramas, that is, regular narrative films that are supposed to be telling a quote-unquote true story. And of course, as we all know, that's impossible. Well, even documentaries can't tell a, you know, there are, depending on how it's edited and depending on how it's put together, there's still going to be issues of, are we really being, you know, are we seeing truth, or is this for real the way that it's being said? But at least with documentaries, most of the time you're presenting your evidence as part of your film, so that hopefully it gives it a better sense of truth. And that's how somebody watching it, just like somebody who reads a newspaper article or whatever, that's what makes them believe whether they're willing to trust based on what evidence you present and how you present it.
That's right, Joel. A documentary is is more than an opinion because it takes into account a multiplicity of divergent opinions. It is not the truth, though, either. It is rather a valid representation of reality, or a representation of reality based on valid sources. Now, that doesn't mean that people can take the same, that people cannot take the same sources and turn it into a very different kind of representation of reality. So, for example, I was the scriptwriter for a film called Berkeley in the 60s, and it looked at the various movements, the free speech movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, hippies, Black Panthers, all from the perspective of what happened in Berkeley during the 60s. Well, one could take very much the same story and make that a documentary about the rise of Ronald Reagan, who became governor and then rose to national fame by using as his target the radicals on campus at UC Berkeley. And writing the backlash against hippies and anti-war radicals. So what documentaries do often is present a perspective on things that is not mainstream, that is not status quo. A documentary about Ronald Reagan really doesn't need to be made, although I'm sure many have been, because the story of his rise to power is a mainstream narrative within our culture. Often independent documentaries will take on subjects that the major media don't cover or cover in a dismissive or minimal way. That, I think, is one of the great benefits that documentary filmmakers have to offer.
When one of the other things, though, and it's not, I know we've been sort of talking about the concepts of documentaries, but I want to sort of broaden this up now, because one of the points you're making, or you know, obviously because it's part of the title of the book, is storytelling. That you can, and this goes back to the definition of documentary versus, you know, that people don't always understand, is that if you're not familiar or don't watch a lot of documentaries, is that good documentaries still are supposed to be telling a story. If you're used to watching documentaries, after a while, it's not unusual to sort of pick up on the back, you know, how a good documentary is created, so that by the time the movie ends, the film ends, you've been told a story in some way, shape, or form. But and I think that's one of the things you talk about early on, is that, you know, we talk about telling stories verbally, and I know from teaching in communications classes that we talk a lot about how before there was a written language, there was a verbal language. That was the only way people could communicate. And of course, those were stories that were passed down orally, that was the way we passed our stories down. And nowadays, we can tell our stories in a variety of methods, and the documentary becomes one of the ways that we can tell our stories.
One of the things I thought about in writing Stories Make the World is the relationship of documentary storytellers with storytellers that go back way beyond recorded memory, so that shamanism is a form of storytelling. I'm sure that the paintings on the caves of Lascaux were accompanied by some kind of storytelling ritual. All of those animals painted on the wall. So storytelling is verbal. It often has visual counterparts. There's photojournalism. I was close friends with a Peruvian healer, a form of shamanism that goes back thousands of years. I got to interview an American Indian oral historian while I was doing some work in Washington State. So all of those experiences with different forms of storytelling and research into them go into my book, Stories Make the World, to put documentary filmmaking into the perspective of this age-old human experience of telling stories and understanding them, hearing them.
And Like you say, stories are what, obviously, what we might call legends now. They're often built on passed down oral traditions where there may have been or likely was some truth that over time. One of the things I always talk when I talk to classes about oral history or more oral traditions is the concept of the game of telephone, where one person tells one thing to one person, and then you wait to see what the story is by the time it gets to the last person. So the story is affected by the feelings and ideas of the people who are telling the stories. And that's why oral history is so interesting, because nowadays historians are just automatically, but we've got oral histories for very many different events. And it is very interesting because you get that point of view, like you were talking about, how two different filmmakers could take the same topics and the same evidence and come up with a completely different story. But it's the idea that you're building it on you still want a story based on what you find and what people say.
That's right. And American Indian oral history is a discipline. People are trained in it from childhood. It's very interesting. It was very interesting to talk to Gilbert about her upbringing. Her parents were oral historians. This is the Upper Skagit tribe in Washington, and she was really trained to listen to elders, to remember things, to have an accurate memory about events that affected her tribe. The Six Nations leaders in the Northeast and Eastern Canada get together every year and put together their founding stories. And they sit in the longhouse until they have a consensus about what all of the details of their history, their collective history, are. So the importance of getting it right. We don't have to remember so much. We can look things up in Google, but many of the American Indians I've known over the years have had very good memories because they grow up in an oral tradition, and one in which one has to be very disciplined in remembering things that are important for everyone.
Well, and of course, as we know, just because it's on the internet doesn't make it true. In fact, it's more these days. Well, not always. I mean, it's one of those things where I hear people talk about that. Well, you can't trust it. You can't trust the internet. Well, you can't trust a lot of things. It still requires the knowledge and the understanding, the critical thinking that you, as the thinking person decides whether they're willing to believe or based on the evidence that's presented. So just because it just so happens that we've got the internet with all this extra stuff doesn't mean that we don't. Also, we haven't always had this issue. We always have, as you point out. It's coming up with what we consider to be the truth, and doesn't matter the incorrect information out there. You still have to go through the process of going through it all and finding out what's true. And you talk about that is that just because you even in the introduction you say actual sounds and images does not ensure truthful depictions of reality. And I think that's the same thing. Just because you have a picture of something or an image of something or a sound doesn't necessarily make it true.
That's right. Having those images, photographic images, gives documentaries a tremendous power, because when we see photographic images, we tend to think, well, that's the way it was. And it takes a kind of literacy to understand the process of selection that goes into taking a single photograph. We can appreciate the great photographers, the Ansel Adams and the Dorothea Langs, and understand that there's a real sensibility behind the images they depict. Well, that's also very much the case when we're talking about documentaries.
So, and I did finally remember the sentence you were talking. The two terms you compared was objectivity versus impartiality. And I think that's where you get into the you were talking about. Objectivity seems to indicate that you don't have a point of view, or impartiality indicates you want to make sure that you're only using material that you can easily, you have evidence for or can prove.
That's right. Objectivity implies that this is the way it is. There's no debate about it. Impartiality can open things up. You can have debates. You don't know if you're impartial in investigating a subject, what you're going to come up with. So it's an approach that encourages skepticism and debate and thought.
So one of your early, and in fact, it's one of your in the first part, Storytellers, you devote a section to Erik Erikson. And the concept that you use, that you talk about a great deal, is the concept of the identity crisis. What does that mean? I mean, what do you see that as? And what are we talking about when we say an identity crisis as it relates to story and storytelling?
Erik Erikson was a psychoanalyst who created a new form of writing. He psychohistory. He wrote biographies of great individuals in history, including Martin Luther and Gandhi. And he became famous in the 60s for his concept of the identity crisis. He developed a theory of the human life cycle, and identity was the stage of adolescence when you figure out what you're about, who you are, how you define yourself, what you want to do in life. And the notion of identity crisis really resonated with youth in the 60s, including myself. But Erikson, whom I was privileged to study with as an undergraduate, Erikson developed this concept as a clinician working with veterans of World War II, and that term was shell-shocked. Today we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. But he found that people who were shell-shocked, who'd gone through these traumatic war experiences, lost their sense of who they were. They lost that connective thread that gave their lives meaning. Erikson spoke about this and wrote about it in clinical terms. But my understanding is that people have a kind of internal story. Maybe it's a story of being a hero. Maybe it's a story of being victimized. Maybe it's a story of one's position in one's family. But there are stories that we tell ourselves and update as our circumstances change that provide a kind of continuity in our lives. Might be the story of our profession, the position we want to attain, or the person we want to emulate. Well, these shell-shocked veterans lost that connection. They perhaps had done things that didn't comport with their sense of who they were. And they fell apart psychologically. That, to me, that concept that Erikson developed says something about how central stories are to our psychological health and how universal storytelling is as just an aspect of being human.
So building on that, then, like I say, your book is in multiple parts. But part one, which you subtitled Storytellers, and Erikson's, as you said, is one, as I mentioned and you talked about, is one of the people you talk about in that first section. Now, if I read correctly, these are all people in that part one, the five people you talk about in part one, Storytellers, are people you had experiences with. These are people you actually knew or know.
None of them is with us any longer, but I knew them all, yes.
So, and the thing is, none of them are you know, you didn't look at them as filmmakers, because they aren't, or I don't think any of them are, but you built them over what they presented and how their information and their knowledge and their material has helped you get a better sense of storytelling.
That's right. And also it shows that everyone is a storyteller. These are five people who are not known as storytellers at all. They're very different in kind. Pedro Azabache was a Peruvian painter and a Moche Indian. Eduardo Calderon, a Peruvian shaman, a healer who used an overnight, an all-night ceremony. Eric Erickson, psychoanalyst. Janetta Sagan, a human rights activist. Hannah Arendt, known as a political thinker. But in each case, stories and storytelling was central to their lives. My chapter about Hannah Arendt, with whom I studied at the University of Chicago, focuses on a story that she told became extremely controversial, her account of the Eichmann trial. But she herself was a very thoughtful student of storytelling. The idea of impartiality and the origins of impartiality in ancient Greek literature comes from her. She loved theater and thought deeply about the essence of dramatic form. So she's somebody who really shaped my approach to playwriting and then to documentary film.
And I think you just said something that I think we all know instinctively, but it actually says it, that all politics is theater. So it's not a big surprise that she would be someone who would draw onto that concept of love of theater.
That's right. That's right. And in her writing, she often used works of literature to illuminate historical events. A very creative thinker whose work has become has had a renewed interest in recent years, because she wrote brilliantly about propaganda. She wrote about ideology. She wrote about the manipulation of reality by political figures, and she was somebody who would study deeply each relevant point of view as she approached a subject for her writing. So she was a real role model for me in investigating deeply and impartially.
Yeah, I think one of the things that she proves, and you point out, is that we tend to go with what we automatically agree with when we read or when we study. And it's easier to do that. The phrase that you mentioned about writers, write what you know, where really it's better to consider it to be the learning experience it should be. That if you only write about what you quote unquote know, you never really learn anything new. And as you just pointed out, the idea is you study things from all different from as many angles as you can while you're trying to create what you think is the story. And I think that's a very good point there.
And then viewers have the benefit of the filmmaker's explorations of reality so that they can expand their own world. They can go places that one can't go normally in one's life, meet people who may not be alive anymore. The reach of documentary films, it's like a kind of Alexandria library with tremendous wealth of stories, information, experiences. In my small way, I try to make that available through my book, Stories Make the World. It's there's a website of my distributor, the Video Project /Stories, from which you can stream and download 7 of the films I write about. So Stories Make the World is one book that comes with its own film festival.
So, like I say, this first section then is about the storytellers themselves, but then you build out into that into a couple of different other ways, including the subjects, how a filmmaker, documentarian decides a subject, and you start to talk a little bit about the subjects. What were some of the subjects not only what you might have been involved with, but ones that you just found to be particularly interesting ways that a filmmaker had decided how they were going, what they were wanted to actually create a film about?
It was really difficult but important to get right was the life and work of Aldo Leopold, who was a great conservationist, but not as well known as Henry David Thoreau or John Muir. yet certainly as great a figure in environmental history, and also a very great writer. But when I was beginning work on this project, and I'd tell people that I was working on a film about Aldo Leopold, people would say, oh yeah, wasn't there a murder trial involving Leopold? 1920s, you know, Leopold and Loeb. People hadn't heard of him. And part of the problem was that although his ideas about ecology and conservation and restoring species threatened with extinction are really beyond our own times. Leopold died in 1948, and there are a few seconds of film of him. He did many radio interviews, all of which are lost. He published one book posthumously. Most of his writing was scattered. So he really wasn't at all well known. How do you make a film about somebody of whom there's so little visual evidence and whose voice is mainly scattered among publications? Well, what we did was combine his life with his legacy, because he's inspired so much work in so many fields, from agriculture to urban gardens to forestry to wildlife management, that we could connect episodes in his life with work that people were doing that was inspired by Aldo Leopold. So that was one of the challenges that we took on. And making that film enabled me to meet some really wonderful people, including some of Aldo Leopold's children who became scientists on their own. I met his daughter, who was 91, Nina Leopold Bradley, who was doing science on skis in Wisconsin. So this gives you an example of some of the pleasure of making documentary films, and also some of what the film itself, the finished film, can offer to the public.
So obviously, and you've already talked about this when we were first starting about your initial foray into understanding documentaries, of you find a topic, you find a subject, and then you learn. You just do everything you can to learn as much as possible about the subject. And as you point out, the what ends up becoming the story, and how do you craft the information that you find into a story, becomes so important. In some of your examples, what were some of the ways that you used some of your own other ways that you used your own experience as a filmmaker to try to show how a story can be built in a documentary?
One of the things that I discovered is the value of having a narrator who's also a character. And this, I guess, comes in part from playwriting. Berkeley in the 60s, which I referred to earlier, had some serious problems in that it had different episodes. I was referring to the free speech movement, anti-war movement, hippies, Black Panthers. There were very prominent people in each of these movements, some of whom are in the film, but there was no person who connected it. So it was just going from one episode to another without the kind of unity that one requires of a work of art, of a play, for example. So I found a person who was interviewed for the film, who was a very prominent writer, poet, playwright, Susan Griffin. And she became not somebody who was involved in all of the different movements in the film, but she became a witness. She became a voice of her generation. So that was a construct, but it allowed me to bring the film together, to give it unity and to give it value. Then I had an experience making a film about the conflicts in the Klamath Basin in Northern California and South Central Oregon, which is where the largest tribes in California are. There was a salmon war over in 1978. It was a conflict over salmon caught by the tribes with gill nets and offshore fishermen. The government weighed in on behalf of the commercial interests and against the tribes. And there was actually a there were actually SWAT teams on jet boats who were arresting Indians for fishing and taking them to a court of Indian offenses. So I'd written a play about this, and I started making a film about it. And I couldn't find the characters that I needed. The leader of the Yurok gill netters, the Yuroks being a tribe at the mouth of the Klamath, had won a Supreme Court case affirming the right of Indians to gill net on the Klamath, but he just wouldn't speak into the camera. He looked down, he mumbled, he was not well. And then I went to try to get the government point of view in this war. I went to the Fish and Wildlife Service. Nobody would talk to me on camera. They claimed that they destroyed all of their records, no photographs. So there I am. I have pre-production money and no film at all. Well, at this time, the another conflict over resources involving fishing opened up. Only now it's throughout the Klamath Basin because of the finding that the coho salmon were endangered. Irrigation water was cut off to the farmers in the upper basin in the headwaters, and now they started doing civil disobedience as the gill netting tribes had done. This was really fascinating, but now I had a film that involved very different communities. Indian tribes in the mouth of the river, farmers and ranchers in the headwaters, government agencies, environmentalists. How was I going to give this a unified story with the beginning, middle, and end? So drawing from that experience with Berkeley in the 60s, I realized that my producing partner, Jack Kohler, could be an on-camera narrative. Jack is a Klamath River Indian who grew up in San Francisco, went to Stanford. He got his first professional acting gig in one of my plays, and he wanted to get into film. So he was producing, and when he went to the Klamath River and met with me, members of the Yurok and Karuk and Klamath tribes, he really gained a sense of his roots. He'd been playing great American Indian leaders, Tecumseh, Crazy Horse in the theater. Now he suddenly got a sense of the reality of who his people were and where they came from. So all of a sudden, we had a storyline. We had Jack's journey along the Klamath, discovering the roots as his own roots, as he investigated the history that led up to the various wars and included the wars over resources in the Klamath Basin. So the lessons that I get making films continue to inform what I do next.
In your review and your study, have you found that this part is, generally speaking, the toughest part of, in many ways, of a documentary filmmaker, is actually being able to find the story that's there, or to find so that you can present it, as you point out, visually? If you don't have audio or video, it's or images, it's very difficult to create a documentary film. So is this what we would consider to probably be the toughest part, you know, this early part where you're trying to do things like that?
Well, that's right. One has to have something interesting for the audience to watch, a challenge, as in my example about River of Renewal. Because they have to be engaging people. Not everyone is comfortable speaking sincerely and informatively in front of a camera. And, of course, they're part of the picture as well. Not everybody is going to take you into their world. So there are a lot of challenges, but finding the right visual material is one of them. Here's a very recent example. We were concluding post-production, at least the rough cut stage of my film Wilder Than Wild, about wildfires and climate change, on October 9th, just weeks ago. I was meeting with the editor and the director to say, okay, we've got a rough cut. Let's record the narration that goes with it and start screening this so that we can move this toward completion. Well, the night of Sunday, October 8th, 17 wildfires broke out in several counties in Northern California. And a wildfire invaded an urban area in Santa Rosa. It destroyed 9,000 houses. It took 43 lives. Smoke was blanketing the Bay Area. You know, we were under a cloud of smoke where we were working. Clearly, this was not the rough cut. We had to add a sequence about these wildfires to our film. So what do we show? Well, the fires were burning that very day, and in fact expanding. And there were news crews out there getting footage, but they often interfere with firefighting. There are 10,000 firefighters coming in to deal with this thing. News crews get in the way. And of course, one has to get permission to go to these sites. So were we just going to rely on news footage? Well, we were able to go to a burned out neighborhood after the fire had passed it, but that doesn't really show the dynamism of a wildfire in a city. What we did find, though, was that a firefighter who came as part of with a fleet of fire engines from the Bay Area to Santa Rosa had a GoPro on his helmet. And on the YouTube, you could see the flames from his point of view from the fire engine. For example, the fire crews were going to join to meet at a staging area in the Kmart parking lot. They get there, they see that this Kmart, 100,000 square foot building, is burning to the ground. You know, he was amazed. He thought they were going to fight a grass fire. Now he's finding that whole blocks are going up in flames within minutes. And they drive for 20 minutes before there's something they can stop. Well, all of a sudden, here's footage we can use. So I found the firefighter. We got permission to use that footage, his GoPro footage. We went to Santa Rosa with him, interviewed him at the site of this burnt down Kmart. Now we had a sequence. So there are discoveries like that that one makes in making a film, but it's a real problem finding the right content to include.
How often in your career, or even from your own knowledge of other careers, other filmmakers, how often have you come up with a concept that you just have never been able to do anything? You just had to scrap it or give up, at least temporarily, because you just couldn't find a way to tell the story.
There's an example in my chapter on Janetta Sagan. Janetta Sagan was in the Italian resistance as a teenager. She made Amnesty International truly international. She brought Joan Baez and Melina Mercouri into the human rights movement, giving concerts, raising public support for the work of supporting prisoners of conscience, which one does through storytelling, by the way, telling their stories, getting people to write letters to them. I thought Janetta Sagan was somebody worthy of a film, although she worked fairly anonymously and no one had really heard of her. My way of doing that, though, was to pair her with Václav Havel, who was at that time the president of Czechoslovakia, a great playwright, who was a dissident when Czechoslovakia was under Soviet domination and military rule. He was a prisoner of conscience himself, supported by Janetta Sagan. So when Havel came to California, she was the person he wanted to meet. I had some footage of that. I thought that a double biography would be the way to make to bring Janetta Sagan's story into the world. They were complementary, someone who championed prisoners of conscience around the world and an example of somebody who was a prisoner of conscience who then went on to lead his nation. I thought it was a great idea. It didn't prove so great in practice. Janetta was one of the hardest interviews I've had. She spoke in great detail. She was a great storyteller, but for some reason, she was camera shy. And then Havel, one of the people I've admired as much as anyone in my lifetime, was quite ill in his last years as president at this period, and his wife wouldn't let us interview him. And then, of course, there are problems with fundraising, which comes with any documentary. But if I'd gotten Havel's agreement to do an interview and to be part of the film, I think we would have surmounted that. So that film didn't happen, and we never solved it. Both Janetta Sagan and Václav Havel died, leaving us with an idea for a project that is represented only in my chapter in Stories Make the World.
Yeah, and it's with any, it's like you say, it's the concept of any work of art has its, as far as I'm concerned, the genetics, you know, excuse me, the gestation, that's the word I was looking for, of any idea. There are so many ideas, and you see that even with Hollywood films, where what they call development hell, when a film is in an area where they're trying to get to a film that they feel they can make for a variety of reasons, either because of who's going to be in it and the script and as any film has the money, that process is the kind that the average person doesn't even think about. And yet I think you do one of the things you present is so much of that background, which I think just to me makes the entire concept of documentary filmmaking much more interesting, is that, you know, the whole process from start to finish of a documentary film is so interesting because of why is it being made in the first place, and what kind of changes. How often have you had to go a different direction because of something you found?
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of money in the feature film industry. It's a business. But documentary films really don't have, especially independent documentaries, don't have much of a business model. We try to raise money however we can. There isn't enough foundation or public money to support the many good documentary projects there are out there. People resort to Indiegogo and Kickstarter and GoFundMe campaigns. Often filmmakers will work on their projects while making a living doing something else, renting out their cameras, for example. So many of the documentaries you see are the work of people who are really dedicated to do them at a sacrifice and who never get compensated economically in a way that's commensurate with what they put into it.
I actually have donated to a couple of documentary projects that went through those funding sources, because I do consider, if it's a subject that I consider to be particularly important and something I want to see, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And in some cases, you never really hear anything again. But in most cases, you get it. You hear enough to know, but you also know it's an incredibly long-term process sometimes, from beginning to end, from even fundraising till when the final project is finished.
That's right. And there are things that a filmmaker feels just have to get out into the world, that are not adequately covered or at all covered at all by the media. One example of this is the film Dark Circle, which I did not work on, but which I admire greatly, which came out in the 80s. It was about plutonium. Well, all this information about plutonium was kept very secret by the United States government. The idea that there was some danger in nuclear power plants, or that the plutonium processing factories at Rocky Flats and elsewhere were endangering public health. All of that information was kept very secret, including from the national media. So a team of three filmmakers set out to make Dark Circle. They raised money. They made a really great film, which without their commitment would of course not have been made, but also which exposed something that the powers that be really wanted the public not to know about.
Well, I think that's why I am impressed when you mentioned about how your publisher put together a website where people can actually reach out and see. How many films did you say? Seven
films. Well, actually, the seventh is Wilder Than Wild, which we haven't finished yet. We're still fundraising for it, in
fact. So six and one.
So you can stream and download six of the films I write about, and as soon as we've got Wilder Than Wild completed, that'll be the seventh.
Well, that is one of the great things. I mean, I joked a little bit about the internet, but if it hadn't been for these modern ways of getting content out, there are a lot of documentaries, even older ones, that would be virtually impossible to see because no one would be showing them. And nowadays, there is a market for it, and it's great that your work and older works of other documentarians going back years and years and years, and even modern ones, even though they have to still come up with the fundraising and produce them, that they can be seen now in such a variety of different ways. And I think that's the positive to me of everything of documentaries, is the positive of this modern methods of distribution.
That's right. And the internet is a great benefit for documentary filmmakers in many ways. It's an unequal research resource. It enables us to communicate with people who know our subject all over the planet and communicate with them instantaneously. It allows us to screen our work at various stages to people who can really help us in developing a project. It helps us so, for example, I've sent out the link to the rough cut to people who know a lot about the subject of Wilder Than Wild to get their input, to make sure all the facts are correct. It, of course, is part of the fundraising process. It's part of the distribution process. So the internet is a great tool. And I think it's entirely possible that documentaries will evolve as internet technologies evolve, so that some of that depth of information and that vertical depth of information, that horizontal connectivity that it offers us, can become integrated into documentary film itself.
Well, I will definitely make sure that we have a link to the companion website in the description of this episode, so that people can easily find the site. And and hopefully, like I say, our discussion of documentaries will, if people aren't as familiar with them or haven't watched many, maybe this will be the kind of ways that they suddenly will learn more and get out there and watch these, view these, because there's just so much out there. And you can, as you point out, you can find documentaries on so many different topics that it's hard to believe that there isn't a group of documentaries for everybody, depending on their particular interests or things they want to learn or know more about, not even learn. So, but Anyway, I really do appreciate you talking to me. I hope that you continue to be successful with your work, because it is, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, we need to have them continuing on. And so it's great that you're continuing to have success. And this book, I think, does a great job of really focusing what a documentary is supposed to be, or what it should be, and how they're developed, and just the importance of the concept of story. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Well, thank you, Joel. It's been wonderful talking with you, and I greatly appreciate this opportunity to reach your listeners.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to Stephen for his time. I found his book to be a great view of his knowledge, as well as the important concepts of documentary film. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.